So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to Review Man.
Waiting, it's an historic edition today of Review Away, as by this time, hopefully, we have eclipsed the 1,000 member mark in our Review Away Facebook group.
Yeah, I'm sure we would have. I'm positive. I think so.
Well, hopefully we haven't jinxed things, but hopefully at this point, when you go to the left sidebar on the Facebook group, it says over 1,000.
Yeah, if we've actually gone down by a member or two.
Then disregard this opening.
Yeah, just listen to this next week when we will probably have been up to 1,000.
So later in the show, we are going to announce what we are going to be doing to celebrate this huge milestone of 1,000 members. So stay tuned later in the show for that. But today, lots of stuff to get to, Wei. In addition to SummerSlam 1991, we have a boatload of feedback from people online. So lots and lots of stuff to chat about today.
As usual. And we make an effort to read every single bit, every letter of your feedback. So do continue to send all this stuff in.
Wei, SummerSlam 1991, it took place in August of that year at Madison Square Garden in New York City. I was all of 7 years old at the time, mm-hmm. as were you.
Yeah.
I assume you did not watch this show live.
I did not. I didn't even watch wrestling back then.
Neither did I. So that'll give us quite the perspective. Also to mention, later in the show, we are going to be joined by Dave Meltzer of the Wrestling Observer Newsletter, who was following wrestling at this time and actually attended this show live at Madison Square Garden.
So a double dose of Dave.
Yeah, you heard him on The Law tonight, and now you're going to get him again discussing SummerSlam 1991. So, wait, let's get into this big review. The show starts off with another awesome Vince McMahon opening. For the match made in heaven and the match made in hell, as nuptials turn to napalm.
Yes.
This was awesome.
It was great.
I love Vince McMahon openings.
Well, it's very, it's just, I think we especially like it because we know what Vince McMahon is now. And just to look back and listen to him scream in this voice, it just really can't be. That's part of the appeal of looking back at old wrestling, is just how campy all the production was.
The announcers for tonight's show, Gorilla Monsoon, Bobby Heenan, and Roddy Piper.
Should we, when you chose this show and you started watching it before I did, you quickly pointed out to me the amount of people that were dead
while watching this show. There were a lot on this show.
Should we list them as we go along?
Okay, well, we're at one here.
Yes, with Gorilla Monsoon.
Yes, so as we continue on with this show, we will add to that number, and it's a pretty scary statistic. Though Gorilla Monsoon, let's, in all fairness,
yes,
did not die of any drug issues or heart problems. He died of natural causes. They go over tonight's show and mentioning the match made in heaven with Randy Savage and Elizabeth getting married, even though they're already married. And Bobby Heenan says he's going to tie the knot all right. It'll be a noose around his neck. Very positive way to look at a marriage. And that leads us to our opening six-man tag, Wei. Ricky Steamboat, Kerry Von Erich, and the British
Dead.
Bulldog.
Dead.
Number is now at 3. Taking on Hercules. Dead. Paul Roma.
Oh, that's right.
And Kimbo Slice's bodyguard, the Warlord, with Slick in their corner. So our count is at 4 after match number 1, Wei. No entrances for the heels. Steamboat is sporting perhaps the world's longest mullet at this point in time and hanging on for dear life to this hairstyle in 1991.
A lot of guys were on this show.
The beginning of the match, the announcers spend time discussing all of the matches on the card rather than what's going on in here. And Piper keeps referring to Bobby Heenan as boobs.
Boobs. Well, yeah.
I guess that's a play on Bobby.
Or Brain, maybe.
Okay. Boobs was the nickname Piper had
Boobs,
for Heenan.
That's right. Steamboat's music here is, of course, well, I was watching the DVD, as were you, and the music, Steamboat's music is edited. And it's always impressive when they do this, because they're able to somehow separate the announcers' voices from the background audio and they can even just put any song that they want over top of this historical call.
Yes, there was no Alan Parsons Project for Ricky Steamboat as he came out. When the Texas tornado is in the ring, Heenan brings up that the weather report says it will be hot and calm, no tornadoes. And I noted it was quite the sight, seeing the Bulldog and Warlord in the ring together.
Why is that?
They looked gigantic.
Yeah.
And this was at a time, this summer was following the George Zahorian trial, and was at a time when the heat was really on in terms of steroid investigation, which would eventually lead to Vince McMahon going on trial a few years later. And watching this show, I don't know if the WWF was just late to act on this mm-hmm. or what the state was, but there were guys on this show who looked insane,
mm-hmm.
as we'll get to later on in the show. Steamboat goes to climb on Warlord in the corner on the second turnbuckle, and this was hilarious because I guess Warlord was supposed to shove him off to the canvas. His arms stayed around the ropes and didn't even move, and Steamboat just acted like he was pushed when no arms moved, and he just took a back bump off the turnbuckle. Like, this was just completely Steamboat working by himself with this stiff. Roma would work on the side of Steamboat. Steamboat, I thought, was very, very good in the role of a babyface selling, especially when he was in there with the Warlord, who needed all the help he could get. They built up to a hot tag to Von Erich.
Piper goes apeshit. He says, "Come on, Texas!"
Bulldog hits a power slam to Roma, but Roma kicks out of the finish, and then Steamboat immediately then hits a top rope crossbody onto Roma for the pinfall, which tells me that Roma fucked up the finish of this match, and it was supposed to be Bulldog with the pin.
Really?
I think so.
Okay. I didn't know.
That's what I got from this.
This is a pretty good opener. Crowd leaves home happy. Or leaves the first match happy.
Okay. Backstage, Sean Mooney is with Mr. Perfect, who calls him the greatest Intercontinental Champion of all time. And he's alongside John Tolis, who was under the gimmick of Coach at the time. And this would be his final appearance for the WWF.
Oh, really?
And John Tolis makes it 5, and Kurt Hennig makes it 6.
Wow.
On this show.
I love these styles of promos with the fake-looking locker room.
I love them.
It was just cameras.
For so long, I just assumed that they were in a locker room before I realized every single show it was the same locker room.
It was a set, yes. And also just a beautifully lit, flat-looking locker room.
Lockers.
Where they somehow fit two cameras in there.
I liked it.
Everybody was good at promos at this time, I found. But they all had a similar style where everybody was just ultra energetic and hyper. Everybody on this show...
Well, they were happy to be wrestlers at this point.
Yeah? Okay. Everybody in their promos, they're just almost given one specific style, and that was to scream as loud as they can into the mic.
And we got some stereotypical promos later in this show. That leads us to the second match in, Mr. Perfect versus Bret Hart for the Intercontinental Championship, probably the match that is most well-remembered from this event. Early on, all Coach does on the outside way is blow a whistle. He never talks. He never advises his client. He just stands there blowing a whistle. That's all he does.
What does Jimmy Hart do?
He at least is screaming into the megaphone, giving encouragement.
Okay.
Coach is just blowing a whistle. What does that mean? Stop? Start?
Blowing a whistle to energize his athlete, to energize his athlete, to just wake him up and feel him more alert.
This was the dumbest managerial gimmick I've ever seen.
Alfonso? Same thing.
Yeah, it was very similar. At least Alfonso was a personality. He did cut promos at times. Tolis did nothing.
He was just there for the visual. Somebody to latch onto Kurt Hennig.
Why? If your name is Mr. Perfect, that means you're flawless.
Yeah.
It means you don't need any help. Why would you need a coach?
Even the best guys need coaches to get there. I mean, like George St. Pierre or Anderson Silva, they're very good, but they have to be taught in their technique before they can perfect it.
But he never says, "I'm perfect." That was Mr. Perfect's gimmick. They did vignettes around it that, look, everything I do, I'm great at.
You're not.
What could this man possibly teach Mr. Perfect?
You're never born... you know, knowing something. You have to be taught to do it. Maybe Mr. Perfect was just able to perfect these techniques at an incredibly quick rate.
Wouldn't you enlist the help of your father then, who was a professional wrestler and who theoretically would have passed this on to his son, his spawn, this perfection gene? This is how you deal with it, son. Not John Tolis, whose days of headlining in California with Freddie Blassie were well past in 1991.
I don't know the details. I wouldn't know.
Okay. That was our analysis of this match. Okay. Perfect comes into this match with a big back injury at the time that some knew about, and it did severely limit him, though you would have a hard time noticing that in this match. Heenan says he heard a rumor that Piper's parents ran away from home, and I laughed at that line. And Piper got very edgy about that comment. Early on, Bret Hart was using a side headlock on the mat, and it was a lot of mat-based early on in the match. Twice during the contest, Piper says that Hart's entire career is on the line in this match, as if losing an Intercontinental title match would end Bret Hart's career. In fact, Mr. Perfect's career was technically on the line here, because he wouldn't wrestle for a year and a half after this. Hmm. Perfect teases leaving the ring, but then Hart not only brings him back into the ring, but tears apart his singlet to bring him back into the ring. Piper says that Perfect may have come in too heavy for this match and been lifting too heavy in the gym for this match, meaning that Kurt Hennig and Shane Carwin had something in common.
Yeah, well,
because Carwin gassed after that first round, and maybe that's what Piper was sensing here.
Came in, too heavy.
They show Stu and Helen Hart in the audience, which to me telegraphed the finish if I had been watching live. Long selling period by Hart. We see a sleeper spot that Hart survives, and then Hart goes chest first into the turnbuckle, which was always one of my favorite bumps that Hart would take, where he would go chest first right into the turnbuckle. Looked always really good, really and different. Hart kicks out of the Perfect Plex for a huge pop. Heenan emphasizes that nobody has ever kicked out of that move, so I thought a very good job here in terms of building Hart here for his comeback. We see a hair mare from Bret Hart that Perfect ends up going crotch first into the steel post from. Perfect was just bumping like a machine here for Bret, even with his bad back. Then Hart went after the left leg of Perfect, setting up the sharpshooter. As he goes for the sharpshooter, Coach gets up onto the apron. God knows what he was going to do other than blow a whistle. But Hart punched Coach, and then Hennig crotched Hart on the ropes by kicking the ropes into his crotch area. And Hennig's hair was the story of this match, of how it progressed into like Carlito looking hair by the end of it.
It was sort of a blonde afro.
Yeah, just from the sweat. Hennig's legs then get caught between Hart, and just out of nowhere, Hart turns Hennig's legs and applies the sharpshooter, and Hedner calls for the bell faster than Montreal here. Like, I don't think the move was even locked, and the match, they rung the bell.
No, it wasn't. I mean, Bret had Hennig's legs. By the way, really, really creative finish. I mean, I don't think anyone's ever seen the sharpshooter put on this way. And it was a complete surprise to everybody at the time, I'm sure. But yes, before even Bret even fully sits up into the move, the bell is rung.
So Bret Hart is your new WWF champion. After the match, Bret decides that this is not enough, and he strips Mr. Perfect down to his trunks. And then he kind of wears his singlet as like a badge of honor that not only did he beat this man for his belt, but he stripped him of his clothing. And then a rare key here for Bret Hart as the winner of the match, which you rarely see in a WWF match.
What do you mean?
Like a key on the screen for winner.
What about the championships? They do them for all the championships.
I've never noticed it.
Well, on this show at least. Oh, they did them for all the championships. And it's important to note that they change the graphic to say WWE Intercontinental Champion.
Yeah, they blanked out all WWF references because we were watching a DVD of this that the WWE has since put out over the last couple of years.
So somebody in the graphics department was able to take a block of text and copy it so that the F changed to an E.
Maybe they had the original project file from 1991.
I highly doubt that. I highly doubt they even had project files back then.
But we then go to Lord Alfred Hayes, who tries to get an interview with Stu Hart.
Dead.
Oh, that's true. 7, 8, 9.
Well, Stu Hart, Helen Hart.
And Lord Alfred Hayes.
Yeah.
Yeah, 9.
Yeah.
Brett comes to hug them. Hayes gets one word out of Stu and then cuts him off. And we get a glimpse of Bruce sneaking into the scene to hug Brett,
that was my
wearing
favorite.
A head bandana.
My favorite.
Bruce, the guy who stomped on Vince McMahon.
Yeah, he just comes in and grabs Brett.
Bruce Hart. We then get a promo for WWF Hot Ticket for Hulk Hogan, A Real American Story, that's coming to pay-per-view this fall.
This was like a commercial that you would see at a student project.
It was terrible.
It was so funny.
Then we see Gene Okerlund backstage with the Bushwhackers and Andre the Giant, who needed these supports to keep himself up at this stage of
his life. He was selling the leg injury, too.
Yeah, that was why I think they did the injury, because he legitimately needed these things. I guess, Andre, you can add to that number. That's 10.
That's right, yes.
Then they show the angle from television where Earthquake attacked the leg of Andre. I'm shocked that Andre, at this state of his health, even did a physical angle, even as limited as this one was, he'd take a bump to the floor. And that brought us to the Natural Disasters versus the Bushwhackers.
Yeah.
And the best way to describe this is what Piper said at the start. A lot of ifs in this match. Yes, a lot of ifs. If this would be even captivating for a minute.
That's right.
Earthquake brings us to 11. Bushwhackers put their ball cap on Andre, and he just stares there. And you can just see the stare of what the fuck am I doing here on Andre the Giant's head. I've headlined everywhere in the world, and I'm sitting here with the Bushwhackers ball cap on my head sideways. And just as I'm thinking this, he reaches up, takes the hat, and throws it off. Awesome spot. I was much more interested, as I noted here, I had just had an extra large coffee and was much more into this match than when I took a break. Thought the best worker of this match, Bobby Heenan, very sad to see him go backstage at the start of this match because he says he's going to go talk to Hulk Hogan. Bushwhacker Luke's offense consisted of stomping on the feet of Typhoon like he was Marco Huas. Earthquake hits his sitting finish on Luke for the win. The one positive here is that when Earthquake would do his finish and he'd start jumping up and down by their head, they would always do a close-up of his feet going up and down. And I thought that made the move a bit more effective. And then they tease the Disasters going after Andre after the match, but the Legion of Doom come down for the save, and they tease a future program with the LOD and the Natural Disasters, who celebrate with Andre and the Bushwhackers. A forgettable match. Not good at all.
No, not very. But it does make you miss tag teams.
In tag teams.
Yeah, when you would actually see more than two teams on a show, and two dedicated teams, not just two guys put together. Two teams with a uniform look, an actual name.
We then go to Bobby Heenan, like 8 minutes ago, had said he's going backstage to talk to Hulk Hogan. And all of a sudden, they came up with a graphic package. SummerSlam special report with Bobby Heenan. And he's backstage, and there's a door with a piece of paper, an 8x10 piece of paper with the word Hulk written on it. Heenan is carrying the NWA title, and he challenges Hogan on behalf of Ric Flair, and the door is slammed in his face. And the announcers just love this, seeing the door slammed in Bobby's face. And we never actually see or hear from Hulk Hogan. Then we go to Sean Mooney, who's with Ted DiBiase and Sherry.
Dead.
12. And this, I think I just watched after Raw. So contrasting these two to Ted DiBiase and Maurice, not very wise if you're a fan of the current incarnation. And they recap the demeaning acts that DiBiase has put Virgil through, leading to this $1 million championship match tonight. DiBiase is sweating profusely in this promo, and he says he's going to leave Virgil with one thing tonight, a crying towel.
Yes.
Any thoughts on this combination of DiBiase and Sherry?
I suppose it was mostly DiBiase. I don't know if Sherry ever added much. Again, perhaps just the visual of seeing DiBiase with this with Sherry automatically put some heat on him. But it seems very different from the DiBiase that we see now, where it's really the girl doing most of the character.
Well, that leads us to Ted DiBiase versus Virgil for the $1 million championship. An early flurry from Virgil, and DiBiase just sells and bumps to get the audience behind Virgil, who, with all due respect to the man that declines interviews from us, very, very limited worker.
Yeah.
Thankfully, Heenan returned here because Gorilla and Piper were wearing thin very, very quickly. Monsoon notes that Heenan's hands are green from holding the NWA Championship, which was a nice little jab. DiBiase is on the offensive until Virgil applies a sleeper, and Sherry runs in with her purse and attacks Virgil for a disqualification finish. Piper is so disappointed, noting how hard Virgil worked for this. The man is nearly in tears.
Piper was, I found him very annoying in this show.
It was just so, like, ridiculously over the top.
Yeah. The way he screams in his promo.
All right!
That's fine, but to do it throughout the entire show, save it for the end of a match when you're supposed to be excited, but the guy just screamed throughout the entire show. And especially putting him in there with Heenan arguing the whole time, it just got very annoying. Just chill out.
Howard Finkel announces that the referee has every right to disqualify DiBiase, but rules that Sherry must return to the locker room, and the match continues. Roddy Piper is so elated that he flies into the ceiling of Madison Square Garden and receives a concussion. The match continues. Terrible punches by Virgil in the corner that don't come anywhere close to touching DiBiase. These are the safest things I've ever seen in my life. DiBiase throws Virgil into the official, Earl Hebner. DiBiase then talks shit to Piper at ringside and knocks out Virgil cold. And then he takes the turnbuckle pad off, and they build to a spot well, I thought, with Piper's yelling. And Virgil counters and knocks DiBiase twice into the exposed turnbuckle. Virgil struggles over to cover DiBiase, and he wins the title. I thought a very good job here by DiBiase. Piper sold very well in this match, particularly at the finish, and this was, without question, without seeing all of his work, this was the best match of Virgil's career, I would assume.
Probably.
And they never, this was what was so funny watching this, was that I don't think we ever heard of this $1 million championship after this match, and yet, months ago, DiBiase Jr. shows up with the $1 million championship with no explanation, just that he showed up with it one week.
Yeah.
And you had the perfect tie-in that you hired Virgil, and he gave it to you. But I guarantee no one who put together that angle had any idea of this.
What do you mean? Steve Austin had the $1 million title.
Oh, shit, that's right.
Yeah,
never mind. How did Ted get it back? Correct me if I'm wrong, listeners, but did Virgil ever lose it back to DiBiase? Maybe I missed something.
They were probably all stripped of the title for not defending it.
All right. I think Virgil is your linear champion.
Okay.
So if you want integrity to be restored to that belt.
Who was the first to beat Virgil after this?
I don't know. That's true.
Someone maybe WCW.
Yeah, it could belong to anyone.
Is it true that Virgil was named after Dusty Rhodes?
Yeah, of course. That was his whole deal. When he went to WCW, as a joke on that, they named him Vince. And then they renamed him Shane. His whole career has been a rib. Backstage, Gene Okerlund is with the Mountie and the officers from New York. They replay the angle from TV where Boss Man was handcuffed to the ropes and he zapped him. And Rougeau notes that these hick cops, as he stutters this in his broken English, yells at the top of his voice, and the cops are trying to keep a straight face here during this segment. I enjoyed this a lot.
Me
I was
too.
A big fan of Jacques Rougeau.
He's excellent.
Sean Mooney is with the Big Boss Man.
Yes.
Such a silly gimmick, but had such big success with it. He's also sweating during this promo.
Oh, my God. And shouting at the top of your lungs.
Yep. I pray to God! Sounded like a televangelist during this promo. That leads us to the jailhouse matchway between the Mountie and the Big Boss Man, which, as a kid when I first watched this match, thought it was the greatest thing ever. And watching it today, a little sad. Match was completely based on the stereotypes of New York City crime and how dangerous their prison system was. Monsoon proclaims this is going to be a classic. I don't think he was a mind reader nor a prognosticator of the future. I've never seen someone try to get so much out of so little as the Big Boss Man with his offense. Like the most basic wrestling 101.
Mm-hmm.
And we just try to milk the audience for every morsel of a reaction.
Yeah.
Boss Man on the floor goes after Jimmy Hart, and the Mountie comes from behind and knocks him into the steps. Piper states, if the Mountie does go to jail, then maybe he will get his man.
Hmm.
Big spot was the Mountie delivering a pile driver that Boss Man sells by having convulsions and then passes out. Monsoon and Piper basically say it looked terrible. Mountie goes for the cattle prod as the ref is distracted, but Hart by Hart and then misses and takes an uppercut from the boss man. Another uppercut by the boss man and a sidewalk slam for a two count. And how did this match finish? Wait, I didn't even write down the finish here. Boss man got the win.
Yeah, who cares?
And then they drag Brujo to the police cruiser and take him out of the arena. I don't know how I missed the finish here. It was a very short match, and the crowd was not into this match at all.
Yeah, yeah. Technically, definitely not much of a match.
No, but this was bad.
But like, it didn't matter back then. The feud was over, and the stakes were high enough. Who was going to get sent to jail?
Well,
the boss man or the Mountie?
Cared.
I think they cared. The crowd was very hot for a lot of these.
They popped later when they were actually taking the Rougeau out of the arena. But during the match, they were pretty quiet for this. Gene Okerlund is with Ted DiBiase and Sherry. And DiBiase is irate over the stopping and restarting of the match, as he should be. I think he should really take something up with the New York State Athletic Commission here.
I wonder why they never gave Virgil any time on the mic.
I don't think he could talk very well. Maybe that's why he didn't talk to us. He knows his limitations. Sean Mooney is in with Bret Hart with the IC title. He gives a little speech. This was just interview after interview after interview.
Bret is the only guy in this whole show who doesn't deliver a screaming promo.
Yeah. Gene Okerlund is with Jimmy Hart and the Natural Disasters. Hart wants his lawyers on the phone to take care of the Mountie situation, and they are pissed at Andre the Giant.
Yeah.
Sean Mooney is with Big Boss Man, fresh off of his win, and Boss Man asked Sean Mooney, "What kind of bird can't fly? A jailbird!" Hilarious, Ray Traylor. Hilarious. He calls the Mountie a criminal and a bad cop. Gene Okerlund then enters the locker room of Randy Savage, who's on a landline, and basically blows off Okerlund, but then Okerlund says the word Elizabeth, and Savage gets off the phone. Then they announce they're taking a 5-minute intermission break on a live pay-per-view. You would never see this today, and why do you... Well, I guess it was for the live arena to go buy shit. That was probably the reason behind it, but did we really need an intermission on a 2-hour and 40-minute pay-per-view?
Coming back, what do we have?
We see the paddy wagon showing up at the police station, and they take the Mountie out of the truck, and Mountie says, "You stupid! Do you know who I am? I'm the Mountie!" And the Mountie starts reading the rights to the officers and singing his theme song. This was great.
The acting is so bad here.
I loved it. "You stupid!" Sean Mooney is with Jimmy Hart and the Nasty Boys, and Hart is beside himself over the Mountie. And the Nasties cut your typical 80s heels scream promo is what I wrote here. Mm-hmm. Then more footage of the Mountie as they take his picture, and Hart insists this is an invasion of privacy. Gene Okerlund is with the Legion of Doom. We get the typical 80s that scream promo with Hawk says that after tonight, the Nasty Boys are going to be the Basti Boys.
What?
That's what he said.
The Basti Boys?
You're going to be the Basti Boys.
What?
I don't know what it meant. I don't know. Oh, Hawk, 13.
Yeah, and you missed a Boss Man in there too.
14. Then the Mountie is getting fingerprinted and gives the middle finger to the officials, and this is censored. Then Sergeant Slaughter, General Adnan, and Colonel Mustafa are with Sean Mooney. Slaughter calls him Puke Face and then refers to the ultimate puke and the immortal slime as Adnan and Mustafa just laugh in the background. I loved this promo. I thought it was great.
Half of Slaughter was wearing a beret and his sunglasses. And
they were Iraqi sympathizers.
Right. And half of Slaughter's sunglasses were fogged up because of the sweat trapped between his forehead and
must
his
have been
beret.
So hot back there.
Well, yeah, under the lights in the locker room,
yeah.
Of course.
Gene Okerlund then interviews a juiced-up Sid Justice, who delivers his typical low-high delivery, and says he is a man that stands alone. And they show a video, then, of Slaughter and his crew offering him a spot as the first lieutenant, and says that tonight, justice will be served.
He was wearing this referee striped low-cut tank top that looked
it was
so
Hebner's hand-me-down.
It was like a dress. It looked more like a striped dress. And this was like the 12th non-wrestling segment on this pay-per-view.
Way too many interviews in a row here.
They must have been sitting for like half an hour, this crowd.
That leads us to a no DQ, no countout match with the Nasty Boys defending the tag titles against the Legion of Doom. Animal early on hits a powerbomb onto Knobs, but Sags breaks up the count. Sags hits Hawk with a tray of pop and ice, and Heenan says that's the first bath that Hawk has taken in a while. And Monsoon responds with, "Will you stop?" Hawk sells and finally makes a hot tag to Animal. The Nasty Boys then grab the motorcycle helmet and Animal ducks, but Sags avoids hitting Knobs and then clocks Animal with it.
Where did he get this motorcycle helmet?
Well, it used to be part of the gimmick that Jimmy Hart would come down with a motorcycle helmet for the Nasty Boys matches. And I assume,
why? Where's the motorcycle?
Well, he just wants the Nasty Boys need protection.
For what?
Well, just
why didn't he have two of them? Why did he just have one?
Why do you need a tennis racket if you're Jim Cornette? Why do you need a megaphone if you're Jimmy Hart? Why do you need a
megaphone so the audience
a tennis
can hear
racket?
You.
Why do you need a tennis racket? Is a game going to break out in the ring? Mm-hmm. A little suspension of disbelief here.
But
this came into the finish.
At least
that's why.
At least a tennis racket is, you know, you can hold it easily. Helmet.
You can wear it. You can wear it.
He never wore it.
I used to always wear a motorcycle helmet when I went out, okay, just to be safe. LOD recovers and both get hit with the helmet. The Nasty Boys do. They hit a doomsday device onto Sags and they get the pin and the tag titles.
I thought the best parts of the match were the haircuts involved. The Nasty Boys had the best mullets, I think, in my opinion, of anybody on the show. And LOD's interlocking puzzle pieces for hair were great.
The Mountie is being taken into a cell and complains about his arm being hurt. Then we get a promo for the Survivor Series coming up this fall. And then, IRS versus Greg Valentine in a match that had no business being on this pay-per-view. Gorilla Monsoon says that the Mountie will have some sore legs tomorrow. I didn't know what this was to imply.
Sore legs tomorrow.
Quiet crowd for this match. With Valentine, not the most endearing baby face I found.
He just seems so out of place in this world. You have these cops, Mounties, and sergeants, and then he's fighting this tax collector whose name just happens to be IRS.
Imagine how that turned out.
And then
shocking.
And then you have plain old Greg the Hammer Valentine.
Well, he wore a robe with hearts on it.
Well, when I first heard of him, I thought he was supposed to be some sort of human hammer. Like that would have been, he should have been like a human hammer, like just wore like a hammer costume.
Could have had a 1991 t-shirt where the hammer is going to nail you.
Oh.
That would have more redeeming quality years later for the double entendre.
Right. And he could do like a diving headbutt with a hammer head.
Oh, why weren't we booking WWF in 1991? Yeah. Quiet crowd for this match. Monsoon mentions that Jake Roberts and The Undertaker have been spotted at Madison Square Garden. Valentine tosses IRS off the top rope to start his babyface comeback. IRS goes knee first into the turnbuckle, and Valentine works the left knee to set up the figure four leg block. Valentine locks on the figure four, but IRS reaches the ropes, and then Valentine grabs him by the legs, brings him back into the middle of the ring, teases it again, and goes for the figure four, but this time IRS rolls up Valentine with a small package for the win. And I'm thinking they could have screwed up the first figure four, and he was supposed to roll him up there instead of him getting it on, but maybe not. Hmm. Not a great match at all. IRS gets your win, and Irwin R. Scheister, the IRS, advances in his
what
destination
what
to
came of this?
Collect taxes through professional wrestling as a warning to tax cheats. Gene Okerlund's backstage with Hulk Hogan and Ultimate Warrior and says Hogan notes he feels the same rush he had on January 23rd, 1984 when he won his first WWF title as Warrior keeps grabbing his shirt. Then Warrior asks, "Are we loaded down?" And they won't come by tank or by air and prepare to go down to the coop of Warrior wildness. And then Hogan talks about toxins. And they end the promo in sync, talking together, and they look like they're going to make out as the promo ends.
Yeah, Warrior just, he puts his arm up as they're delivering the final line. Warrior kind of puts his arm up around Hogan's head, and it looks like they're going to make out. Why do they kept talking about cobras in this promo? two of them. They both reference cobras.
Maybe Slaughter, he had the cobra clutch.
Oh, okay.
That was probably why. They probably wouldn't be able to answer the why for most of these promos.
Hey, wasn't the Gulf War over by this point?
It was, Way.
So why?
Well, they were just trying to milk it, I guess.
But it was already done. What were they fighting for?
I don't know. Maybe, you know, they're on the road so much. Maybe Slaughter, Mustafa, and Adnan didn't. They didn't have the internet back then.
They didn't know that it was over?
They might not have been aware. Hogan and Warrior were like, sure, why not? Let's keep it going.
Okay.
Both guys come out to a lot of... the heels come out to a lot of heat from the New York crowd. When Warrior comes out, Heenan notes that this guy makes Coffee nervous. They show the super fan in the front row with the tank top and shaved head who's on just about every single WWF show at this time. The babyfaces work on the arm of Slaughter for the first few minutes, and Hogan and Warrior make frequent tags. Sid gets in the face of Hogan to make sure he obeys the five count and threatens to disqualify Hogan. They did the camel clutch spot with Mustafa and Hogan, and Piper brings up that this reminds him of 1983. It was actually 1984, but Warrior breaks the hold, and what was funny was that Colonel Mustafa was working under a different name in 1984. I don't know why they didn't call him the Iron Sheik, but for whatever reason, he was Colonel Mustafa during this run.
Yeah.
Piper yells, "Come on, Warrior, get off your butt and tag," during this match. Warrior gets a burst of energy, but then all of a sudden he remembers he's selling his lower back, and it just comes out of nowhere where he grabs his back.
It was really weird. He was on the ground on his back, and then he does a weird sort of a pelvic thrust. Multiple pelvic thrusts on the mat as he's about to get up. Like he's hulking up from his groin.
Warrior grabs a chair and he chases Mustafa and Adnan to the back. And then Hogan ends up hitting the leg drop onto Slaughter for the win after powder is thrown at Slaughter.
Yeah, why did they both of the babyfaces cheated here. Unprovoked. They both cheated.
Well, this was a match made in hell. There's no rules in hell. Hogan starts posing in the ring, and then he calls Sid back to the ring. Sid looks so confused as Hogan tried to bring him back to the ring. Hogan tears off his dress shirt, and Sid and Hogan pose together, which was quite the visual here. With all this steroid stuff going on at this point, you had Sid and Hogan posing like absolute ridiculous muscle heads here.
Mm.
And we get one more Mountie vignette in the cell. Some dude in leather and a bandana says, "Hi, don't you just love the way leather feels against your body?" And that's our final vignette with the Mountie yelling as we are to assume he's going to get raped.
Yeah, well, rape is hilarious.
Apparently to the WWF at this time. And that brings us to the main event, Way, in front of the New York audience. We get a recap of what led to the Randy Savage and Elizabeth marriage angle on pay-per-view.
Dead.
Oh, fuck. 15, dude.
Yeah.
They replay the interview segment on Superstars where he says that he loves Elizabeth, pulls out the ring, and then has second thoughts and looks at the crowd for encouragement. And Piper yells, "Get down on your knees." And Elizabeth responds when asked, "Will you marry me?" She says, "Oh, yeah."
Then that was really sweet.
It was, Way. We then get a musical tribute called to the song called "Together," with all of the hijinks and romance between Randy Savage and Elizabeth over the years.
This was about as perfect as it could have been. This song and this video, which lasted forever.
It was a long video.
20 years later is the perfect time to watch something like this.
The highlight of this video was this cheesy, cheesy love song as they show Elizabeth running in front of the honky-tonk man who's about to cork Savage with a guitar to emphasize the love these two share for one another.
That's how you demonstrate your true love.
This random dude comes down and is introduced as the best man. Heenan asks, "Why do they call the second guy the best man?" Piper sounds like he is legitimately choked up at this ceremony. They tease Savage getting cold feet on the altar, but he ends up saying, "I do." Even in a wedding, they have to book ring psychology. And Elizabeth does as well. They say, "I do." And the show goes off the air. This is how we ended SummerSlam. And
but
they would shoot an angle for this with Jake Roberts and The Undertaker, yeah, but that was not part of this DVD.
They edited the wedding reception off of this DVD.
Well, I assume that was part of the, yeah, the home video, because you couldn't have shown that right now, like on a live pay-per-view.
But that was on the home video, and in many people's minds, this show does not end at this point.
That's where Jake and The Undertaker crash the wedding ceremony. They open up a gift. There's a snake in there. They attack them. Lovely WWF wedding angle.
The Undertaker just looks so out of, so weird here. You have Jake the Snake Roberts, and then you have this zombie in a wedding. A zombie.
Just, you think, like, someone would have noticed the zombie wandering around who's
carrying
an
urn?
He stuck out a bit.
It would. I will have to say, though, it would be the creepiest thing in the world to see this giant zombie at a wedding with an
That's
urn.
True. So that was SummerSlam.
Who just got married himself, by the way.
That's true. Yeah. So, wait, that was SummerSlam 1991. And out of 10, where do you place this one? As much as I enjoyed the Bret Mr. Perfect match, and I did get a kick out of the Jailhouse match, I'm only going to give this one a 5 out of 10. This one didn't light my world on fire.
Yeah, there's nothing particularly... Listen, everything was cheesy about this show, but it was at a time when you expect things to be cheesy, and thus, there's like just a feeling of... it just feels retro and kind of cool. So it wasn't very fun to make fun of. There's really not that much there. If anything, it was just kind of sad seeing how many dead people were on this show.
15.
20 years.
And granted, some of them were like Andre, John Tenta, Lord Alfred Hayes. I mean, those were natural causes that led to them. But you're still looking at like 7 to 10 guys that did not die of natural causes, that did not make the age of 50. That to me was really depressing.
If you're watching a World Series baseball game
from
20
1991.
Years, yeah. Like when the Jays won, for instance, how many of those guys are dead?
From the Braves and the Jays, I can't think of anyone.
Okay. Yeah, whatever. 5, 6, whatever. Who cares?
We're going to go to my conversation I had with Dave Meltzer, the editor of the Wrestling Observer Newsletter. He attended SummerSlam live, so let's go to that right now.
Today we are reviewing the SummerSlam 1991 event that took place at Madison Square Garden, and someone who actually attended the show is the editor of the Wrestling Observer Newsletter, Dave Meltzer. And Dave, let's just first chat about this event. Obviously a lot of people look back, and it's the wedding angle that stands out the most of this event. Very unique by WWE standards, putting this on your number two show as really the main drawing attraction, and in the New York market nonetheless.
Yeah, in the building, it was not a. It was kind of a weird thing because there were definitely people who were into it, and there were also. I remember a lot of people leaving the building, and not being into it. I mean, my memory of it, you know, when you bring up SummerSlam '91, is the Bret Hart Kurt Hennig match.
Yeah,
I mean that stands out because it was, you know, I was in New York, you know, for several days before the event, and that was the match that everybody was talking about in that city, and it was, you know, at the time. You know, Mr. Perfect Kurt Hennig was pretty much established as Intercontinental Champion. We knew he was going to lose because he had the back injury, so that wasn't, you know, that. But still, people thought, you know, this was going to be, you know, a great wrestling match. And the thing was, as you would recall from that period, you know, Bret was a tag team wrestler and it just started as a singles wrestler. So this was like I guess it's hard to say because the Intercontinental title, it was so much bigger then than it is now. I mean, this match was the match that made Bret into a legitimate singles top guy because you would headline shows as Intercontinental Champion. So, you know, it was like the biggest, it was by far the biggest match of his career, and he had a great opponent, and that's what I remember the most. The other thing I remember is just the whole deal with Ultimate Warrior getting fired right after the show.
And I do want to ask you about that Warrior story, but just quickly going back to Kurt Hennig, I mean, in terms of on the WWF side, was it well known that he was going to be gone for the significant amount of period he was, or was this something that they didn't necessarily know how serious this back injury was at the time?
Well, he had wrestled sparingly, if at all, for months. So, I mean, we knew he was hurt, and he was really in no condition to wrestle, even though he ended up having an incredible match that night.
Yeah.
You know. But no, I mean, as far as like, did we know he was going to be gone for as long as he was? I don't remember thinking like he was going to be gone, but you know, for like, you know, a year, or it was career threatening or anything at the time. I just remember that he wasn't going to be wrestling again. We figured for a couple of more months, and it was like, it was pretty much a given that Brett had to win just because Kurt wasn't going to be around. So Brett winning was, I remember going into it, Brett winning was like a foregone conclusion, at least to what we knew. I didn't know that Kurt would put him over clean with a sharpshooter or anything like that, and that Kurt would be able to have the match he had. You know, I mean, even though, I mean, everyone was buzzing about the match with the idea that it would be, you know, one of the all-time great matches, but I was kind of concerned because I knew that, you know, Kurt Hennig with a bad back, I mean, what are you going to get? I mean, we knew it'd be, you know, it was going to be good to a certain level. I mean, Brett was that level of a guy and everything. But, yeah, that's really when you talk about that. I mean, that show, the thing I remember about that show was that, and also being around Stu and Helen Hart in the stands that night, which was also pretty entertaining.
Oh, I can imagine. And you even do get a glimpse of Bruce somehow making his way into the camera when Brett is there, which I guess Bruce has made a bit of a staple of over the years. Let's chat a bit about the Ultimate Warrior story, because that was the other big story coming out of this. On the Warrior DVD, we certainly got the WWF's narrative of how everything went down, but of course, anyone who got your newsletter shortly after that DVD, it wasn't as clear-cut as the Warrior simply showing up that day and demanding a gigantic raise.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny watching that DVD because, you know, everyone's out there, and I mean, it was just so funny where you have like guys like Jake Roberts and Hulk Hogan talking about, oh my God, this was so unprofessional and you'd never do this, and I just cracked me up. But what happened was, months earlier, you know, Warrior went and made demands to Vince that he wanted to be paid. Essentially, he wanted to be paid what Hogan gets paid for pay-per-views, which, you know, to me, I was shocked when I heard that, you know, Vince, I guess, agreed to it. And I guess he agreed to it because the show was coming up. And at the time, you know, the match had already been announced. You know, it was Hogan and Warrior against, what was it, Adnan, Sergeant Slaughter, and Iron Sheik, right?
Yeah.
As Colonel Mustafa.
Mm-hmm.
And so Vince didn't want to change the main event, so he agreed in writing to, you know, Warrior, I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was like $1 million or $1.5 million for a pay-per-view, which in those days, you know, or even today, you know, even today, a WrestleMania main event, you wouldn't make that.
Oh, yeah.
So think about it, and think about in those days when there weren't as many homes that had pay-per-view, and the price of pay-per-view was much lower and things like that. But Vince agreed to it, and I guess his agreeing to it was just to not ruin, you know, in those days they plan so far in advance, you know, unlike now where they plan a week in advance if you're lucky. So he agreed to it. It was in writing. And then the day after the match, Vince fired him because he didn't like what he agreed to. Is essentially what happened. And there was, you know, there have been lawsuits about that going back and forth. So
also, at this time period, the summer of 1991, at this point, the Arsenio Hall show took place that summer. The Zahorian trial had gone down that summer. And yet, the closing scene in the ring after that main event is you have Hulk Hogan and Sid Justice posing in Madison Square Garden. Was it a case of the WWF that all of this outside pressure hadn't really hit Vince at this point? I mean, where were, because some of the bodies on this show are just amazing, considering what was happening at that time period.
I don't think that it really hit them until the show was in the end of August.
Yeah.
Even though the trial was in July, and they did announce steroid testing, although they had yet to start testing, I think that it didn't hit, I think that Vince did, you know, it didn't hit Vince at all. He thought that he was way above it, that there was no, he could do whatever he wanted, that whatever pressure there was had come and gone within a week, and it really wasn't until November, December, and really January the next year was when it really hit big, January and early February. And so at that point, yeah, you know, it's like, it was funny watching it because it's like they're under, you know, a lot of publicity was out, but it was clear at that point, as you can say, by the end of that match and by the bodies on the show, Vince didn't care yet. He was going to care, you know, and he started caring a couple months later.
Yeah, it's amazing too, just going up and down on this card. And granted, some of these are natural causes, but 15 people that appeared on this show are now dead.
Isn't that unreal?
Like, you look at, you know, I don't know the statistics of, you know, the Super Bowl that year or the World Series, but
come
I mean,
on.
It's no, I like, would, if there were two, it would be surprising to me.
Okay, I could tell you that we did a thing. I remember looking back, and this was actually for the one of the shows in 89. Might have been the 89 SummerSlam. Might have been the 89 Mania. So this is a couple of years later, and I don't think there were 15 on those shows. So this is actually might be the peak. But you would have to go back to the World Series, to the 1960 World Series, for as many people who have participated in the World Series. And also keep in mind, there's 25 men on two teams, so that's 50 people, which I guess is, I don't know how many people were on this show, but it was probably less than 50. But you would have to go back to the 1960 World Series, not even 61, 62. You know, and so that's 30 years older guys instead of dying at 45. You're talking about guys dying at 75 to where you would have the same type of numbers. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's one of the always very sobering parts of ever going back in history here and looking up and down the show. As well, in the Observer where you covered this event, you noted that the following night was Vince McMahon's birthday in New York City at the Rainbow Room, and I'm just curious if you got to attend Vince McMahon's birthday that year.
No, I didn't. I'm trying to remember. No, wasn't the year that it was like a big thing. It was. That was also funny, too, because it was supposed to be a surprise birthday party, but it was at, like, the Rainbow Room in New York. I mean, how could it be a surprise? You know, it's like he booked this giant birthday party to be his surprise party. But that was Vince, you know? I mean, you know, that's – I mean, I remember in late 85, I don't know if you remember this, but it was a garden show. It was a couple months after WrestleMania. And the British Bulldogs came in and brought this giant trophy to Vince for the genius that created WrestleMania. I'm just going like, and it was like supposed to be the surprise. It's like, Vince bought this.
I've never heard that story. That's a great story.
They presented to him the genius that created WrestleMania.
That's something else. What was your kind of relationship like with Vince and the company at this point in 1991?
Well, I mean, I think that I guess it was at one of its better points historically. I mean, Vince had a meeting with me and a couple of other reporters, just a couple of days earlier, right before the show. And that was actually one of the reasons, maybe even the main reason that I was at the show, is because we met with Vince and everything. And he invited me to come down and tour the place. And, you know, and Vince in person is super friendly, you know, I mean, I don't think that we were ever, you know, we talked kind of a lot, but I don't know that we were ever close. It was always kind of a wary relationship. I don't think he ever really liked me and kind of, understood my role, you know what I mean, or the role of reporters. Vince never was, you know, Vince has never warmed up to reporters, and he's always had his ups and downs and thinks that they're out to get him, you know, and so that was kind of the deal. But, yeah, you know, it was definitely an interesting week for sure.
The current Observer is out, Dave. You've got the big directory, which I'm always a big fan of, that you do on an annual basis now.
Yeah. We have all of the WWE wrestlers, their how long they've been wrestling, how old they are, and then we have the sports background. Not just sports, also entertainment, modeling, dancing for some of the women. The background of, you know, all the people who have backgrounds. Some people just, you know, were wrestling fans and came through the indies. But, you know, like anyone who played college football, college basketball.
It's the one issue Matt Stryker needs to obtain every year.
I didn't say where everybody was trained or anything, which I probably should have done, because it's amazing of all the people that went through Calgary when on that pay-per-view, when Matt Stryker had to name three people who came through Calgary, and he only got one of the three right.
Oh, yeah, with a gorilla
monsoon.
On the top of our
heads, we could name, you know, 40 wrestlers who went through Calgary that ended up being big names, and he comes up with Gorilla Monsoon, who's, you know, probably went through Calgary at one point in his life, but he certainly didn't start there, and, you know, is, you know, or Edge, who everyone knows, you know, started with Ron Hutchison in Toronto.
Oh, yeah, like right around the corner here, yep.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, Dave, thanks a lot for this, going down memory lane with us. Much appreciated, and we always appreciate having you on Sunday nights.
Okay, cool.
That was Dave Meltzer, editor of the Wrestling Observer newsletter. For more information, you can go to WrestlingObserver.com, and Wei, we will now dive into the feedback. Dan Danielson starts off, LOL at the idea of a wrestler called the Young Bluer Line. I always thought it would be funny to have a tag team with a Billy and Chuck or Lenny and Lodi gimmick and call them something like Michael Church and Thomas Wellesley. Church and Wellesley. You got to be a Torontonian to get it. Yes, which is primarily why this would probably not work on a national level.
No. Muzubadi, thanks for posting the Mel Gibson rant. Holy shit, I had no idea about this. This guy is beyond a psycho.
Gary from Australia here. Love the show and I listen every week. Great job with the Warrior DVD review. During your review, you mentioned that Warrior wrestled Triple H and squashed him in a 90-second match at WrestleMania. Is there any truth to the rumor that this was Triple H's punishment for the whole Click incident and that's why Warrior squashed him? Thanks, guys. Keep up the great work. It actually wasn't as a result of that because the whole incident at Madison Square Garden took place a few months after WrestleMania 12. And not prior. It was essentially the Warrior came in, and that's what he was doing, as he told Triple H and likely management.
Jermone Jackson. Hey, guys, just listened to the No Mercy review. After seeing Zach Allen show up on SmackDown, I was wondering how long it would take before a heel would use the one-legged man in an ass-kicking contest cliche. Vince never fails when it comes to political incorrectness.
Uh-huh. Brian Kwan writes, hey guys, I laughed out loud with the ad waited during the law, and it made my Monday morning. Excellent review of No Mercy 2003, and I love that John Pollock avoided answering Wei Ting's question of who after the name of Chris Benoit was mentioned. I'm curious, did anyone notice during this time Chris Benoit was wearing different types of tights in 2003 and then changed back to his normal ones in 2004?
Nope.
I did not.
Richard Lee. Hey guys, great job on the No Mercy review, though, as I said last week, I wasn't really a fan of the branded pay-per-views at the time, though the wrestling at the time was 10,000 times better than the stuff we see today. Anyway, going to SummerSlam 91, I remember watching it as a kid, and we'll try to hunt it down to bring back some memories of watching it at a Chinese food restaurant bar basement on Naren Avenue in Winnipeg. But guys, at the end, please play some music again. The Mel Gibson call. Holy shit. I had heard about the calls on the news, but to actually hear it, that's a different story. Thanks.
Just bringing everyone up on what Hollywood's talking about. Stephen James Wright, feedback for next week. I actually won one of those viewer's choice contests. I was watching a bootleg internet stream of TNA Slammiversary last year, and the secret code word came across to win a Slammiversary prize pack. I entered it in my info thinking that they'd check to see if I'd ordered the pay-per-view. They didn't, and I got in the mail a prize pack of TNA Second Degree Burns music CD, which is the drizzling shits, might I add. Can't believe that with a title like Second Degree Burns. The three previous Slammiversaries, and my personal highlight, a 2009 Slammiversary shirt with my personal most hated fucking wrestler of all time, Jeff Jarrett. This shirt is the ugliest, most gaudy thing I've ever seen. By the way, they only gave out one grand prize, and since I won it from watching a bootleg feed, that should tell you how many people actually ordered the pay-per-view. Wow.
That's great.
That's depressing.
Excellent. Brian Fotheringham. Hello, John and Wei. Awesome review of No Mercy this week. I can't wait for the review of SummerSlam 91, as it was the first wrestling show I ever watched. It was a match between Bret Hart and Mr. Perfect that made me a lifelong wrestling fan. If you really need an extra special show for the 1,000 member mark, I would suggest the co-promoted WWE and GGW Girls Gone Wild pay-per-view from March of 2003. The show was everything you might be interested in. Drunk wrestlers, a terrible body contest between Tori Wilson and Nydia, Snoop Dogg saving the day, and it is under 90 minutes in length. Also, if you're looking for a song to close out the show, I would recommend Waiting by the Cat Empire.
Ah. Cody Brown, excellent review this week, fells. I remember the Stephanie Vince match as being pretty damn decent considering the competitors. I have a suggestion to commemorate your 1,000 members. Have that person call in and review a show with you. I don't know how well that might work, depending on where that said person lives and all that, but I think that would be an awesome experience for someone. Anyways, keep up the good work, guys. Fortunately, our phone system is not the most ideal for something of that nature. So,
yeah,
we cannot facilitate that at this point.
Wolfman Handsome. SummerSlam 91 featured that excellent or perfect match between Bret Hart and Mr. Perfect. Watching Mr. Perfect's compilation DVD, it is interesting to note that these two had almost identical matches in 1989 and in 1998. Also, if I could, I will throw in my guess for the name of Wei's Childhood Wrestling Federation. Since he was so very embarrassed even to say the name of it, it must be pretty bad, so I will go with Suck My Cock Wrestling, where the loser has to suck the cock of the victor. I don't mean to slander you, Wei. I just try to think of what Unspeakable's acronym, SMC, could be. If I'm correct on this, then does that mean SMC rules apply? Haha, fucking pervert. Keep up the good work, fellas. Let's move on.
Mark Sherman in capital bold letters. SummerSlam 91 was the pay-per-view that got me hooked. I'm 25 now. Perfect versus Brett was the shit. If I had Warrior's last match for a while, it had Warrior's last match for a while. Start of Jake Roberts' heel turn. Mountie Bossman jailhouse match was great. Mountie's feet kicking when he was in jail. They had a fucking awesome SummerSlam theme that I used to hum all the time. You've hummed it too. Great pay-per-view altogether. Very entertaining announcing as well. Keep up the good work, guys. That's a succinct review there.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
We should get this guy to co-host the show.
Oh, yeah. We just, that'd be a 10-second call. Yeah.
Dan Danielson. Yo, John. Thanks for giving the rub to Placebo in this week's review away. Placebo is one of my favorite bands ever, and Shawn Michaels being my favorite wrestler made this promotional video so enjoyable for me. I remember favoriting this video on YouTube as soon as I saw it, and I even posted it on SureDog.com's UFC forum with the caption, MMA could never tell a story this good. Needless to say, I got a lot of heat from the wrestling-hating UFC fans for that. But I don't care. I got to represent. I was sad to see Shawn lose that match and retire because I think he's the best performer in the business, even today. But it's also special to see an athlete go out while he is still at the top of his game. I love the way that match ended with the symbolic storytelling of Shawn mustering his last ounce of strength to slap the dead man in his face, and the Taker turning around with the scariest facial expression I've ever seen and delivering that awesome jumping tombstone pile driver. Simply amazing.
Alex writes, hey guys, love the show. I download it every Monday morning and listen to it on my way to work. You guys make me laugh so much that as much as I try to keep quiet, I end up laughing, and people on the TTC buses and subways give me weird looks, like, why are you laughing this early on a Monday morning? In response to your question on what I would do if it was my last night before going to Iraq, if it was me, I wouldn't go to a wrestling event or MMA, but I would spend it with my family and friends having a barbecue. Smell something burning? That's just review away roasting bad wrestling pay-per-views. Also, in regards to what you guys should do to celebrate 1,000 members, how about having a draw and sending the winners a mini Scott Putski award? I know I would want one. Keep up the great work. P.S. Since everyone butchers my last name, I won't hold it against you if you do, too, but it is pronounced Kramer's, but it would be really funny to listen to you guys try to say it. How would you ever get Kramer's from this guy? You see the spelling.
Kramer's.
Kramer's would be Kramer's. My guess, but it is Kramer's.
Okay. Gal Shaw, hey Wei and JP, I just wanted to suggest you do a review of CZW Tournament of Death 8. This event featured an insane match between Thumbtack Jack and DJ Hyde, as well as a near-death experience for Nick fucking Gage, who, by the way, seems like a huge cock-sucking douchebag. That is all.
All right.
Well, that's a good one.
CZW Tournament of Death 8. Andrew Patterson writes, a dingo is a dog, not a hog. Good show.
Did you say that it was a hog?
We read the response of that one guy last week.
So it was a hog.
Big debate here on what a dingo is.
Yeah. Biggest fan review away. Hey, guys, I enjoyed the review of No Mercy 2003. I think it would be cool if you guys had Mouth or Agnew on for your first show with 1,000 followers. Also, that Mel Gibson taped phone conversation was brutal, but probably a much better heel promo than the horrible one Rhino cut on the ECW November to Remember show you guys reviewed. Keep up the great work. Still the biggest RAW fan of all time, reeking up arrogance cologne.
Ron Zawacki writes, you should review some shoot interviews. Some new good ones I've seen are Viscera, King Kong Bundy, and the London and Kendrick shoot, where London says, yeah, John Morrison is real cool, except for the fact he let Batista screw his girlfriend to move up in the company. Now, that's awesome.
I want to watch these. I don't know if
I don't really want to review. What are you going to review? Yeah. You're just going to say what they've said? Like, you're not... Nah, shoot interviews aren't that fun.
It's like reviewing... Just the conversation, yeah.
Yeah.
Padrage Mood. Is that right? Padrage Mud?
Yeah, he did send us in the pronunciation. Okay.
The second half of 2002 and the SmackDown pay-per-views from 2003 are probably the most easily rewatchable shows the WWE have put out. was saying Mel Gibson sounded like the Ultimate Warrior in the tape when it leaked. Ron's shoot interview suggestion seems a bit difficult because it's basically just them talking to a camera. All you could do is recite it. Maybe Forever Hardcore, Beyond the Mat, or The Backyard. I think there's very few chair shots in it, actually. Would be more suitable? Yeah.
We actually have all of those on DVD of some sort from I know someone sent me The Backyard for the Fight Network.
What is that? Documentary?
Yeah, it's a documentary on like indie stuff, backyard wrestling that I've never seen. Mark Cardoso, I remember watching No Mercy 2003 at a friend's house and thought the show was okay. But then again, we spent most of the pay-per-view drinking beer and just about laughed our head off at the stupid logic to Linda Miles' boob job. After hearing your review on the Warriors DVD and pointing out the fabrications, maybe you guys can do the Pick Your Poison Jake the Snake DVD. I remember John doing a Lock Christmas promo and redubbing the DVD Pick Your Fabrication. It was it would be interesting to hear what was fact and what was fiction.
Ron's the wacky. Just checked out the first match of SummerSlam, and I believe Kerry Von Erich is quite impaired. Notice he goes the wrong way to enter the ring, and then he gives the dragon a long hug before the match after he messes up who is supposed to start the match?
Perfectly possible. Sean Prasad, am I the only one who didn't know what a Prince Albert was? I screamed when I Googled it.
Yeah, I knew what it was, but then I've never actually seen it, so I Googled it, and wow.
It's graphic.
Image.google.com.
Imagine that being your name.
Prince Albert.
Some fan who's like 10 years old, like wants to go find his website.
Yeah. Jack Pisco. Well, isn't there a Prince Albert? Isn't Queen Elizabeth's husband Prince Albert?
Queen Elizabeth. She doesn't have a husband.
Yes, she does.
The Queen.
Yeah.
No, I think you mean the...
No, I'm talking about Queen Elizabeth.
The old one. Oh, well, he's dead, though.
No. The queen right now has a husband.
Are you sure?
I'm pretty sure.
Okay, I don't know.
All you UK listeners, correct us.
Set us straight and also include the power of the monarch. And is it really even... What do they do?
They're just the figurehead at this point.
That's it.
Yeah.
It's like you have your prime minister running the country. And these people are just there. And
Let us know if you're... Your kingdom has a Prince Albert.
Okay.
Or has if you've ever had a Prince Albert. Jack Pisco. On No Mercy 2003, this was a decent pay-per-view with some great matches. Around this time, I wasn't watching WWE, so going back, I had low expectations. The Cena angle bet was a welcome surprise. Who knew Cena had more variety in his in-ring work earlier in his career? Huge wrestling angle as well. Being in a match with Angle must have had that effect on people. There were some cringeworthy moments, especially when Benoit was dropped awkwardly on the chair by Albert. The Steph Vince match was bowling shoe ugly and way too long. In the Taker-Lesnar match, the FBI run-in made no sense to me, and that biker chain was placed too high on the pole. Looking back on this, I wonder if Taker was the one to inspire Lesnar to get into MMA. To John and Way, a great idea to plug RAW during the LAW. Keep saturating the market, you guys.
Andy Gordon, the No Mercy review was great with awesome matches except for the APA match. The Mel Gibson rant at the end was funny as hell. Could you guys please review the 1999 SummerSlam with Austin versus Triple H versus Mankind for the WWE title?
We can. Dennis Amaya, holy shit, you guys. You're only 6 members away from reaching 1,000. What's the big plan? Great review as always, and I would really enjoy for you to review more SummerSlam since it's coming soon. Thanks for all the great laughs, and keep up the great work.
Richard Holm, great idea to build up this year's SummerSlam. I would love to listen to reviews from old SummerSlams, preferably any from 90 to 95. I'm really looking forward to this week's review of the 91 event. I don't remember much about that show, even though I think it was the first WWF VHS tape I bought when I was a kid. But when I was a kid, I used to fast forward to the Hogan matches, haha. Looking forward to kicking back on the couch and watching this event before the review. Looking down the card at the 8 matches, it looks quite strong with not much filler. Oh, there was filler. in the fact that pretty much every single name on this card is recognizable, even to this day, 20 years later. A few of the guys on this card may not be great wrestlers, but they didn't need to be because they all had such strong gimmicks and personality that the audience knew exactly who each and every guy was.
We'll I agree
with that.
Yeah, I do agree.
Rohan marketing in the 80s.
Yeah. Rohan Unrell, good stuff as always. I marvel at Way's ability to bring logic and deductive reasoning for all wrestling situations, regardless of their idiocy. SummerSlam 91 was the very first WWF pay-per-view that I watched. In a small Manitoba town, we were one of the only houses that had a dish capable of pay-per-view.
He could have gone to the Chinese food place.
Yeah, on Niven Avenue. 19 years later, the Bret Perfect match still stands up as an all-time great, even after seeing it through 2010 eyes. After not watching that match since probably 1998, I still remember every spot, every word of commentary. I vividly recall the television build-up for this match and how much of a big deal it was made out to be. By comparison, most of 2010's WWE matches are designed not to mean a damn thing, because the all WWE programming is vanilla and bland. It makes me pine for the days of only 5 pay-per-views in a year. A few things of note I remember on the show. I love how the cop at the prison is quite knowledgeable of WWF 1991 storylines when he took the Mountie's photo. So I guess the boss man kicked your butt. I was hoping beyond hope that we would actually get First Lieutenant Justice. What a dick Lord Halford Hayes was. No selling Stu Hart during his interview. What a shitty wedding reception Savage had when the only co-workers that you invited was Sid and Mean Gene. Was Macho Man just a bastard and didn't invite anyone? Was Liz a bitch and told him, I'm not inviting him to my wedding? I invite Wade to please analyze this. By the time you read this, you'll probably have reached 1,000 members. Congrats on the journey. Your humble little review show has become a staple of my day.
Well, of his day.
Of his
that
day.
That means he listens every, day.
Every single day to these words?
Yeah.
Well, in answer to your question, I think maybe Liz, maybe they just couldn't afford. Maybe they couldn't afford inviting so many people.
Weddings are costly.
Oh, yeah.
Have you ever watched I Do Let's Eat?
Nope.
On the Food Network?
No.
Get a better sense. Oh, these weddings are a lot.
And I'm
I love that show.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm sure why they invited Sid and only Mean Gene. Maybe, maybe Sid doesn't, maybe Sid doesn't eat a lot.
Maybe. Let's finish off with Jordan Welsh. Man, fuck WWE at the moment. I don't mind the money in the bank on Miz, as John and Ting said. Like Punk, Like Punk, he's nowhere near ready to be a top-tier champion at the moment, but I do hope they stick with Miz and the briefcase for, like, say, the next 4 to 6 months or so to bring him up. But Kane winning money in the bank, I don't know, man. I smell a trap and an Undertaker-Kane program. So, Jordan, everybody, thanks for your feedback. That might have been the most we've ever gotten in 1 week. And we encourage everyone throughout the week to post up on our Facebook group, the Live Audio Wrestling Review Away Facebook group, or just type in reviewaway.com. That's reviewaway.com. And now for next week, Way, to commemorate 1,000 participants on our Facebook group, we are going to celebrate by we got a number of votes that you guys want to hear Dan the Mouth Lavransky and Jason Agnew make a special appearance on Review Away. So next week's show, we are going to have Dan the Mouth Lavransky and Jason Agnew in studio with us, and the four of us are going to review an event. However, we're going to let you guys decide what event we review. So we're going to need you guys to we're going to give you 24 hours here to choose. Monday at midnight Eastern time, I figure, will be the cutoff.
Sure.
That gives you the day on Monday to email us. So we only want people who are dedicated listeners and are listening on Mondays to download it.
Yeah.
And we only have so many days to watch this whole thing, so we got to be fast. We're going to put the options up there on the Facebook group, but they are going to be Bash at the Beach 96, mm-hmm. ECW Heatwave 98, ECW Heatwave 2000, the China pornographic endeavor.
No, it's not a porno. It's just a movie.
It's the movie with China.
China's
Illegal Alien.
Illegal Alien.
Okay, we are not doing the China porno.
I don't want to.
I don't either. I thought you would put that down.
Well, I wouldn't want to review a porno with four dudes in a room. That'd just be so weird. listening to Dan and Jay.
So for all you smart asses who are going to email that as a write-in, we are not accepting it. It's China, illegal alien.
Which is just as funny, I'm sure.
And then as well,
WOW Women's of Wrestling.
Yes, the WOW Women of Wrestling pay-per-view from 2001.
Yeah.
And so those are going to be the five options that we will put up there, and we will select one of them, and the four of us will all review it next week along with your feedback. So that is our way to celebrate 1,000 members. And as we finish off here, Wei, are there any closing words you have?
We'll just want to say thank you to everybody for supporting us and our little podcast throughout however many months that we've had, and joining our Facebook group. And please continue to stick with us. And please spread the word. Hopefully we'll reach 2,000 and we'll have an even better surprise.
And to go out, everyone, we kind of chatted about it earlier in the show. This is a Jim Johnson original. It's called Together, and it was the music video used for Randy Savage and Elizabeth's wedding video.
When you came into my life, then I realized you were the only one.
When you came into my life, you made me